Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hi, welcome to this special episode from the Agora Podcast Network. The topic of today's conversation is the current political crisis in the country of Ukraine. Today we are joined by two of the newest members of the Agora Podcast Network, Brock Rademan and Pete Sleeman of the Lands of Leviathan podcast. Like I said, today we're talking about the crisis in Ukraine and what's going on in Ukraine and what got us to this point in the Ukraine. And to start off, we thought that we would just introduce what we're talking about and what's the current situation, and Brock are going to fill us in on that.
Hey there, guys. So, yeah. So, for just the crisis in Ukraine that's happening at the moment, I'm sure that most of you have seen this in the news often, all the time, about what's happening. And it's really interesting crisis, actually, because Ukraine as a place exists as kind of this buffer zone between Europe and Russia, and has often played a part of being an area of contestation between these two very large powers. So I'm sure that many of you are aware of the Crimean War that happened in the late 1800s, and a whole bunch of other contests that happened between Russia and Europe, and to a certain extent between the Ottoman Empire as well. But to bring it to the modern part of this conflict, it occurred mainly because the then president, who, please don't hate me for my pronunciation, Viktor Yanukovych, was engaged in discussions and agreements with the European Union of whether to join or not. And Yanukovych actually suspended these talks, which eventually led to outright contestation between people who were pro this agreement and anti this agreement. And it actually brought to bear a whole bunch of other ethnic disagreements that had been fermenting in the region for quite some time. So Ukraine is home to quite a large number of ethnic Russians, or sometimes referred to as Russophone peoples, who speak Russian. And though a lot of those people are left over from when the Ukraine was controlled by different dimensions of the Russian Empire as well as the Soviet Union. Now, Russia definitely took advantage of the situation where it annexed Crimea in 2014. And Brock, I don't know if you will disagree with me, but this is actually one of the first annexations in international politics that we've seen by like one of the big powers since essentially the Second World War. So it was really interesting for us political scientists to have a look at. But I think
it was interesting. I'm going to jump in there because it was quite a unique historical occurrence in the under the microscope of the last 50 years. But it was not necessarily surprising. It was it was a historical practice that normally took place between large powers, political powers, or even empires. And nowadays, you understand it's quite rare for a country, even a country as large and powerful as Russia, to annex a territory because it's so strongly frowned upon in the international community, given the international norms of territorial integrity and sovereignty. So because Crimea belonged in the contemporary international system to the sovereign state of Ukraine, it's really strongly frowned upon that Russia had such influence over the annexation of Crimea. But yet, at the same time, like I said, it wasn't that surprising, given that between Viktor Yanukovych's rescinding or walking back of the discussions with the European Union and the subsequent referendum that took place in the Crimea to establish what the sentiment was among the people there regarding their feelings towards Russia and how badly they want to be a part of the Russian state. And that referendum came back as a 97%, well, very controversial, 97% in favor of joining Russia. And when that result was released sometime in March in 2014, then Russia took advantage of that. And they jumped right in and they said, right, because these people want to be, they consider themselves Russians, and because they want to be part of the country of Russia, we're going to take it over. Ukraine having the sense about itself to not contest that violently, they reluctantly handed it over. So people kind of understood historically and they understood legally what had just happened. And so it wasn't all that surprising. But yes, it is certainly, within the contemporary world of politics, quite an anomaly.
Now, to explain it further, so there's a divide between the East and the West in Ukraine. What's the battlefront now, or what's the crisis at this moment?
Well, it's interesting now because you've actually got a bunch of separate regions that are, you know, largely separated between North and South. So the northern part of Crimea is still, you know, Russian separatists getting involved there. The southern part of Crimea is still under a certain amount of control of the Ukrainian government, but they're still under conflict there. You know, Brock will talk more about this because I think he knows a little bit more, but you've also got quite a bit of like Russian separatist movement in the eastern part of Ukraine totally. So it's important to note here that Crimea is in like the northeastern area of the Ukraine, which puts it on the border with Russia. And it's, you know, north of Kiev, which is the capital city. And what's interesting here is that it provides quite a lot of contact between Russia and the what is now the NATO-controlled part of Europe. Which is one of the reasons why Russia did this in the first place, was to create a buffer between a Ukraine that is part of NATO and Russia herself, which obviously wants to stay as far away from NATO. So you've got these battle lines being drawn pretty much down the middle of Ukraine, separating the east and west from each other.
Yes, that's quite accurate. The eastern part of Ukraine, like Peter says, is definitely sympathetic towards the Russian state. Given that they consider themselves Russian, a lot more than half of the population there, if you ask them, you know, what nationality they belong to, they would tell you that they're Russian. They speak Russian, they go to school in Russian, they practice Russian traditions, customs, and they're part of the greater Russian culture. Thus, this great sympathy for rebel movements and rebel separatists within that area, within that geographic area, that wish to break away from the Ukraine. And currently, that sentiment remains strong. It has been stronger over the last 2 years than it is right now. We know that since the ceasefire in February last year, things have calmed down to a certain extent, but it remains a crisis. Things are still heated, and separatists still exist, and they still wish for their territories to be reunited with Russia. But that is not going ahead. There's a very slow political movement on that front, and fortunately, sober heads are prevailing in preventing all-out warfare within that zone. It would, if it had to happen, if things had to escalate in that region, I would predict, in my personal opinion, it would look something like Kurdistan in the north of Iraq, that do not necessarily want to be a part of Iraq. and sympathize maybe more a bit more with Turkey, but I'm prepared to be a sovereign nation. Yet they will choose to sympathize more with one of their neighbors. So in a war like that, it tends to be protracted. The conflict can become more than political; it becomes cultural. And you know, as conflict drags on, so it becomes historical, and it'd be very difficult to solve a problem like that. Which is why, although things could be worse in the Eastern Territories with the separatist movements in Ukraine, it's important not to let anything get out of hand, and that's why it remains a crisis. It's a powder keg at the moment that if not dealt with soon, although peaceful now, if not quenched for good, could lead to protracted antagonisms between Russia and the greater region of Eastern Europe and the European Union.
Peter, S and Brock, do you see in the Ukrainian context, is the religious aspect as important as it is maybe it is in other conflicts around the world?
Well, to be honest, I think that the religious impact is actually not as important in this conflict. And in a lot of times, religious impacts are overblown by media and the way that these things are reported. Because religion is a very easy explainer of specific things. Oh, it's religious conflict, that explains it, we're done. What I would say more is that it's a cultural conflict. And the reason I say that is if you go back into the history of the region, you know, Russia has been essentially separated from European political development basically up until the end of the Second World War, and since the creation of the Ottoman Empire. Once the Ottoman Empire took over, and if you look at a map of where the conflict is now, all of that area was controlled to a large extent by the Ottoman Empire. And that led to a situation where Russia, which was a European power before the Ottoman Empire, had to develop independently. Suddenly, with the demise of the Ottoman Empire in the First World War, the creation of states now, which Ukraine was one of them, as well as, you know, what was Czechoslovakia, which is now obviously the Czech Republic and Slovakia, it created a whole bunch of different political units, which Russia and Europe now had to deal with, but with two very separate ideas of how to deal with them. And if you, like, Brock is our international relations expert, so, you know, I'm sure he'll weigh in here. But I think that really one of the biggest things here is that the West at the moment, which I'm excluding Russia from, operates on a very idealistic idea of international relations. They want to try and create this globalized world of a community of nations, which was the founding principles of the United Nations. And you know, America, as being one of the vanguards of this idea, along with NATO, has been trying to draw in a whole bunch of different actors into this idea, which is a very cultural Western idea of creating this community of nations. Russia, on the other hand, operates on a much more realistic theory of international relations. They see any incursion into their space as an aggression. So when, for instance, Ukraine got invited and accepted into the NATO alliance, that created a very scary situation for Russian international thinkers and foreign policymakers, because it meant you had an essentially foreign power right on your doorstep, which Russia's never been used to because they've always had buffer states. So what you have here is something that was coined by a thinker called Samuel Huntington. It's a clash of civilizations. One is Russian, one is European and American, two ideas coming together that might not necessarily gel that well. Now, on one side you do have Protestantism and Roman Catholicism, and on the other side you do have Greek Orthodoxy. But I don't think that they're that important. I think that's a way to explain it that makes it very simple. But I think if you look deeper, these are cultural conflicts that occur continually and have been occurring for the past couple of hundred years.
I agree with Peter S. there. If we look at the history of Russia's influence in the Ukraine and broadly throughout Eastern Europe, it has definitely been one of a realist nature. Even before, you know, the state, when it was back when it was the Soviet Union, it was very big on exercising its sphere of influence, on expanding its sphere of influence. And that sphere of influence is basically, it can be sometimes a geographical area in which there's a physical location where of Russian presence, where they're able to control policy, where they're able to influence public opinion, where they can produce certain media outlets, where they can host public rallies, and they can ultimately culminate support for the dominant regime. But a sphere of influence can also be an intangible room in which there's an ideological power behind Russian dominance, in this case. And both spheres, the tangible, the geographic location, and the intangible sphere of influence, were both used by Russia in very smart and powerful ways to overwhelm parts of Eastern Europe, to get people to buy in to being Russian, to identify with the Russian culture and the Russian identity. Now, part of that was religious, where people were inclined to call themselves Russian Orthodox, or at least participate in religious practices that were not intensely European, then Mother Russia would condone that. But if it had its say, it would ultimately override political conflict. It did. Historically, Russia has not enjoyed practicing religious customs, or at least accentuating the religious aspects of its culture in a way that jeopardizes its political stability and its political influence and its political strength. So while we have seen antagonisms between religious factions, between Russia and the areas around it, and particularly in the Ukraine, it's not been a driving force behind the conflict where, as much as it has been in the past. And we could certainly look to use its behavior in the international realm, and it particularly within its spheres of influence, that explain this conflict a lot better, such as ideological propaganda and cultural differences, where we can see, if we had to look at this in terms of, if I had to try and vindicate this opinion, I would look to the types of conflict that are being practiced by the parties involved. So if it was true that the religious conflict here was salient, you would see you would see old-fashioned pitchforks and torches coming out. You would not. You would see bands running around in the streets, seemingly disorganized, rather vehement, malicious, but ultimately on the grand scale controllable. It would not break out across borders. It would not gather international movements, perhaps international sympathy or support, but it would be a rather disjointed effort between the factions. And that's not what we see. Instead, what we see is a far more cohesive insurgency that is organized around ideological similarities. They are not as active as insurgents could be, but they are certainly well equipped, well armed, well trained, and they share strong political motivations rather than religious ones. So, because of those features of the fighting factions, I'm inclined to say that religion is not at the heart of this conflict.
What it sounds like you're saying is, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the religion is almost a way to just another piece to identify which tribe you're in.
Yes.
It's another, you wear a certain soccer shirt, and it's a way to say that you're either more Russian-focused or you're more Western-focused.
I agree with you. I think I shouldn't undermine how intense the conflict is, and when it is this calamitous, you will look for anything in your enemy that differentiates them from you. So if they happen to be part of a different religion, a very powerful identity factor, then of course you will mention that as part of your differences, and like you say, it could come down to the sports team that you support. So whatever can be made salient, almost will be made salient, but unfortunately some types of journalists will jump onto that to explain away the complexity of the situation.
And now if we were to look at, maybe get a bit more into these factions, the divide, I'd like to understand a little bit more about Western Ukraine, because that seems, they seem to be intensely focused towards wanting to be integrated to the European Union and to the West, but then you do have these areas of the East that don't want to be in that sphere. Is that going to lead Ukraine to being split?
I will let Peter S. answer that question. But before I do, I just want to address your question. I would like to identify the two warring factions first. So Western Ukraine, of course, feels deeply afflicted by this conflict. And of course, they are directly involved in it. But they aren't the active participants in it. So to deal with the factions involved, we have to identify the Russian sympathizers in the East and the fact that they are ideologically motivated to separate from the Ukraine and be annexed as the Crimea was, and the opposing faction to them, which is the traditional Ukrainians in East Ukraine, which to a certain extent are less powerful, are less persuasive, and they're largely less represented in the government. Where the western part of Ukraine, I'll let Peter Sleeman talk about that.
Well, I think Brock's asking me to talk because he doesn't want to make a political prediction, which is always scary. You're absolutely right. What makes this interesting is that the western part of Ukraine wasn't part of the Russian Empire. It remained, largely independent from Russia. It was a province of Austria-Hungary. So it was, you're absolutely right, it was part of a western sphere of influence, the European sphere of influence, as opposed to the eastern side of Ukraine. So there are definitely, as we've discussed already, conflicts between the East and West, different cultures coming into clash, different ideologies and different religions, different identities that are constantly fighting with each other. Now, is this going to lead to a secession? Well, on one side, it already has. To a certain extent, we've already had secession referendums. We've already had conflicts arising out of the want for sovereignty. But it's very difficult to say one way or the other. And I can hear Brock already thinking and wanting to accuse me of being a fence sitter. But I think that the reason for that is because there's a lot of international pressure on both sides. So the West, and with the powers on the Western side, I think America will mainly be one of the biggest, considering that Europe at the moment is in its own crisis. England's probably just about to leave the European Union. That's a whole different thing. But I don't doubt the European Union is going to be too worried about Ukraine at the moment with their own thing going on. America would not want Ukraine to split up any further than it already has, and that's in order to keep NATO intact. And America historically has been very good at attaining its own interests, except for maybe Vietnam. But it's been usually very good at keeping countries that it wants together and stopping countries and breaking up countries that it wants to break up. So I think it really comes down to who's going to win that power struggle. Is it going to be America or Russia? But at the end of the day, I don't know how the split would happen if it happens any further. I mean, Crimea has already been annexed. It's already done. And Crimea is what Russia wanted. Well, it's what Russia's wanted for a very long time. Now, would it split any further? I'd have to say that from what I'm reading, it's a possibility, and it's a probable possibility, but I'm not sure that America would allow it, because this isn't just a normal conflict. This is an international conflict between two very powerful ideologies being played out. To a certain extent, and I know that some political thinkers have already done this comparison, it's almost reminiscent of a Cold War scenario playing out, because this is exactly what Russia and America did during the Cold War. They couldn't go to war with each other because they both had nuclear weapons, so they fought proxy wars in different places. Cuba, Angola, different areas in Africa, constantly. There were always proxy wars going on, and we saw the effects of those, and a partition happened, such as what happened in Korea. And this can be seen to a certain extent as a continuation of those conflicts, with Russia stepping up its game as a world power. So I'm not sure is my answer to the question of whether they're going to split or not, because there are very powerful players that are, you know, that are involved here. What I would like to bring up is just, sorry, Brock, just to interrupt you, is Brock and I recently did a talk on the Panama Papers, and Poroshenko, who is the president of Ukraine at the moment, was very heavily implicated in the corruption scandals of the Panama Papers. Now, that's going to have an effect on the demographics of on the people of Ukraine. Poroshenko has often shown himself or presented himself as a very high-minded, fair, ideal politician, and he's proven himself not to be. Now, the effect that that's going to have, I think, is going to lose him a lot of trust in Western Ukraine and vindicate a lot of his antagonists in Eastern Ukraine. And I think that, if anything, that would probably add to the possibility of a split happening.
To Brock or Pete S., do you think that NATO will directly get involved, or the United States? Is it that important, and what would be the consequence of that?
Look, again, it's difficult to say. In international relations, things move incredibly fast, and you've seen that NATO gets involved in things that they said that they wouldn't, and they don't get involved with in things that they probably should. So, last thing that NATO was involved in was the conflict in Libya, which they were very much criticized for. NATO is an international treaty signed between a whole bunch of Western states, America, England, France being the major ones, but there are tons of different states involved in that. But unfortunately, NATO is often seen as an American actor. It's not, but America does have very strong sway in that. Now, I don't know. It's difficult to say, because, you know, it refers back to your earlier question of whether Ukraine could split or not. And as I said, Ukraine already did split. I don't know if we've mentioned this before, but the Donetsk People's Republic, they did self-proclaim themselves as independent. Now, I just saw that they have signed an agreement that says that they will reintegrate as long as they get some kind of self-government in a new constitution, basically setting up Ukraine as a federal state. Now, if that happens, I don't see any reason why NATO would want to get involved. And not to mention the fact that if NATO gets involved in a conflict that involves Russian fighters, that's a recipe for disaster. And American policymakers know that very much. They're very aware that they don't want to get involved into any kind of close quarter combat with Russian fighters. And neither does Western Europe. England and France, basically any nuclear powered state, will not want to get involved in conflict with any other nuclear powered state. So I would say it's unlikely, to be honest, that NATO would get involved itself. They might definitely support the Ukrainian government in form of arms or training, or, you know, through putting further sanctions on Russia and anybody else who's involved. But I doubt very much that NATO itself would get involved to exacerbate the conflict. That being said, I don't know, I could be wrong about this. We've learned to be very careful about the predictions we make about what's going to happen in these very highly volatile conflicts.
And really, the way it looks now, the situation right now, and probably going forward, being that the Europeans have a lot more on their plate right now, and even the United States has a lot more on its plate, that it'll become just a proxy war where the U.S. and the West and NATO will give as much support as they can, but not so much to the degree that they feel that either side's going to go to a full-blown conflict. And the Russians can, they've pretty much got what they want out of the deal from the sounds of it.
To respond to your question, Steve, about the delicate nature of this conflict, given that the subsequent actions could be seen or could be treated as a proxy war, I would say, in my opinion, it has already been a proxy war for the last 2 years. Russia was able to convince the international community that it just wanted a tiny sliver of land called Crimea, and when it got that, it pulled its hands out and it made public statements saying that it had no more interest in the Ukrainian, in the future of the Ukrainian people. However, when we later discovered that, you know, Russian jets had been violating no-fly regulations and they'd been seen over the border of Ukraine, plus the fact that, you know, paramilitary troops had been discovered sneaking across the border to carry out covert military objectives, it became quite clear that Russia wasn't quite done with Ukraine, and probably still isn't. But that doesn't concern NATO. It still doesn't concern NATO to the point of intervention. It came very close, but it still kept its hands out, allowing the Ukrainian government to deal with the problem mostly on their own. And the reason I believe that is because of the real conflict that has caught the eye of NATO, that's in the Middle East. And because NATO has such a large mandate in the Middle East and has so many conflicting allegiances and pockets of power with which to interact, it has found itself almost at the mercy of Russia, strangely enough, peculiarly enough. Not that it depends on its cooperation and its allegiance, but more that it just wants to keep Russia in the known field. So rather than having to add Russia to the list of factions whose intentions are unknown, it's quite happy to be semi-friendly with Putin and his administration, particularly his military advisors, so that whatever its interactions are with Turkey and with ISIS, that NATO doesn't have to count on its cooperation, like I said, but more just know what its intentions will be, and it can count on them to follow through on those intentions. So with both eyes on the Middle East, I think that the NATO's interests in the Ukraine are trying to leave it be as long as possible, and treat it more or less like a proxy battle in which to ideologically engage with Russia, but not militarily.
And Pete, do you have anything that to wrap up for today?
Yeah, I think, you know, I completely agree with Brock.
Of course, I'm a superior student.
I think what's important to note here is to look at the, you know, who's trying to do what. You know, every international actor is attempting to maximize the amount of power they have in the international sphere. And, you know, Russia is kind of getting back on its feet after, you know, a huge amount of changes that happened since the fall of communism. And it's really starting to, you know, throw its weight around in the international community. And, you know, Brock alluded to that with, you know, Russia going up against ISIS when America was kind of not really willing to get involved again in another conflict in the Middle East. And if you, you know, just, I would say, look at a map of Europe at the moment, and you can see that Russia is buffeted essentially from the West by three states. It's Ukraine, Belarus, you know, Lithuania and Latvia to a certain extent, but Belarus and Ukraine are the big ones. And you can see, if you have a look at any kind of Russian foreign policy, those two states are very important to Russia's interests because they keep Russia safe from the West. Russia doesn't know what the West is trying to do, and Russia knows that it doesn't have any love lost between itself and the West. And, you know, the Western powers, which are, you know, largely represented by NATO and the United Kingdom and France and America, are also trying to expand their influence the other way as well. And as Brock says, you know, trying to contain the situation going on in the Middle East at the same time. So I would say that if the West is willing to let Russia be, then Russia would probably be willing to settle down a little bit. But I doubt that that's going to happen. I would say, if anything, we are getting into a period in international relations where it is going to be a little bit of a struggle between Russia and the West. But, you know, in my opinion, it's a struggle that the West is going to win at the end of the day, because Russia doesn't have the economic power, nor does it have the longevity to sustain any kind of long-term Cold War 2.0, if you will. So, yeah, I mean, it's very interesting, and I think it'll be interesting to keep an eye on it. But, you know, with the whole world focusing on the Middle East, I think the Ukraine will kind of simmer down, the lines will formate, and, as Brock said, it's likely to become a federal state, which would be the pragmatic response to the conflict at the moment.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on, and this was an Agora Podcast Network production. You two are the hosts of the Lands of Leviathan podcast. Can you tell us a little bit more about your podcast?
Sure. We are hosts of the Lands of Leviathan podcast, which is what we do is we analyze political and international relations theory, try and make it accessible to people through popular culture. So we've done state formation by looking at the zombie apocalypse. We've done Star Wars and looking
what
at
about
the
today?
Way the UN
Tell
functions.
About today.
Yeah, today, we have a podcast coming out really soon, which is all about the Panama Papers, political corruption, and we discussed the very cool vampire movie Daybreakers, which was a fun movie that Brock and I both enjoyed. So yeah, we're basically trying to make political science and international relations theory a bit more accessible to everybody through popular culture.
It's a great concept because, I mean, as much as many people are interested in political science, to tie it together with the pop culture is just, it's...
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
It's a hilarious show. It's informative. So everybody should definitely go and download it. If they do want to download it, where can they find more about you?
We have formed a website, landsofleviathan.com. That's the best place to start. But obviously all of our podcast episodes are hosted on Acast. And you can find all of those episodes on the Agora Podcast Network. Plus, they are on, well, we're getting ready for the YouTube outlet. And of course, SoundCloud and iTunes are also on that list. But Acast and the website and the Agora Podcast Network are the best places to start.
Yeah, and obviously Facebook and Twitter under Lands of Leviathan.
Yeah, but we don't, you know, those social network things, we're not a big fan of them.
You're not a big fan of them.
No, they're for teenagers.
And thank you again for joining us today, and we will talk to you next time.
Thanks very much, Steve.
Thanks.
We appreciate the opportunity.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.